The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, we're looking at a part of the Bible that's about, usually Christmas. And my guess is, if you're like me, when you think Christmas in Sydney, what do you think of? Well, shopping and Santa Claus. Does anyone know why Santa Claus is dressed in red and white? Yeah? Coca-Cola, exactly. In the 1930s, Hayden Sunbloom, who was a graphic designer with Coca-Cola, drew Santa Claus in red and white, the Coca-Cola colours. It was a big hit, and then every year until the 1960s, he drew Santa Claus in red and white, and that's why... Yeah, that's why it wears red and white. There's shopping, and it takes over the whole thing, and then the whole of Christmas is kind of Disneyfied, if you like. There's snow everywhere in Australia at Christmas, Mickey and Minnie Mouse and elves, etc. And yet, if you actually read the Gospels as they're presented, and what I'm hoping to do over the next few weeks is to just look at what is it that the Gospels say as we just simply read them and look at them. The Christmas story is anchored in history, and it's anything but Disney. Now, I found this this painting on the web, and Leon Conay, Peter? Conay? I don't know.
Oh, I do not know. My French is not...
But if you look at her, if you can see her, he's actually got he's got Matthew chapter 2, as she holds her child, desperately trying to hide and to save the little one's life, and it's anything but Disney. So let's have a look. I'd like to read Matthew chapter 2 with you and show you how what we know about this Christmas story intersects with what we know about history. And so there's quite a lot of content. Forgive me if I go a little quickly, but you'll get most of it. Last week we said the two gospel stories that tell of the birth of Jesus, two out of the four. Matthew is written from Joseph's perspective and Luke is written from Mary's perspective. When you put the two of them, they tell us different things, but when you put the two of them together, you get the 3D picture of the birth of Jesus. So, in your hand is Matthew chapter 2. Let's read it. Matthew chapter 2, verse 1. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who's been born King of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." Now, the older versions of the Bible translated Magi as wise men, but that Magi is the literal word. And you can see how we've got the word magic, just add a C, or magician, into English. In those days, though, to be a magician was not pull a rabbit out of a hat. It was all tied up with astrology and the occult, the spirit world, that kind of thing. Elsewhere in the Bible, or the New Testament, where this word is used, it's actually very negative. Talks about a couple of people who are sorcerers in Acts, and so it speaks very negatively. Here, these men, however many there were, doesn't say, get a very positive spin. From the east, possibly Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, there's one legend about them being from Yemen, because the kings of Yemen at that time were apparently Jewish, but who knows, they're legends from the early church, the New Testament doesn't say that. Now, why have they come? There's a prophecy in the Old Testament that talks about a star indicating the birth of a great king from Israel. So the book of Numbers, written by Moses about 1400 BC, Numbers 24, "I see him but not now, I behold him but not near. A star will come out of Jacob," another way of speaking of Israel, "a scepter will rise out of Israel." And this prophecy was well enough known for the Roman historians Tacitus and Suetonius to quote it. And so we come to the star. Paul Barnett, in his book, his excellent little book, by the way, if you want an introduction to the history of the New Testament, is the New Testament history still in print? Brilliant. Dr. Barnett lectured at Macquarie University in ancient history. He quotes an ancient document that gives some insight on this. Now, depending on your age, Time Magazine 1976 may be ancient. I've managed to track down. Here's the manuscript of Time Magazine. I'll read to you something of what they say. They talk about the fact that there were no comets in the sky around the time of the birth of Jesus. But here's the theory. "But there's one kind of celestial display that could account for Matthew's reference to the Star of Bethlehem. Studies of early calendars and historical records of events immediately preceding and following the Nativity suggest to many scholars that Jesus was probably born sometime during the fall of 7 BC. I'll come to that in a moment. That year, the heavens offered a display that few who studied the stars would have failed to notice. Three times in 7 BC, there was a conjunction of the same two planets. Conjunctions, or what seem to be close approaches of planets in the sky, are common occurrences. They take place at periodical intervals as the planets orbit the sun at differing angular velocities. In May of 7 BC, Jupiter, which astrologers of the period considered both a royal star and a lucky one, moved close in the sky to Saturn, which was believed to influence the destiny of the Jews. Even more significant, this conjunction occurred in the constellation of Pisces, where celestial events traditionally foretold incidents of great importance to Israel. In September of that year, Jupiter again closed in on Saturn. Some astronomers and biblical scholars speculate that the first conjunction may have been the signal that started the Magi on their long trek to Israel, the second, the beacon that guided them on their journey. Now, when I read that, Time magazine doesn't give any footnotes or further things to chase up. I thought they were reporting on something that had been discovered in the last 10 or 20 years. When I had a little further look, Johann Kepler, the German mathematician and astronomer, wrote a book or a paper called The Star of Bethlehem in the early 1600s, explaining this conjunction of the planets. So Time magazine was reporting on something about 400 years old. Interesting, Kepler didn't think that the conjunction of the planets was the Star of Bethlehem. He thought, yes, the conjunction started the wise men on their way. He thought it was a supernova, a star that God had put in place. Now, later, I found out Bishop Munter of Zealand, by the way, I finally found out New Zealand is named after, anyone want to guess? Zealand. Okay. And anyone know where Zealand is? It's an island in Denmark, spelt with E-A. If you spell it with double E, it's a part of the Netherlands. There you go, you did learn something this morning. Okay, do you think New Zealand? From Denmark. Now? Sorry?
Can we go?
No, not yet. There's a couple more things. I couldn't resist that. Okay. Bishop Munter put forward about the conjunction of the planets, and that became quite well known. Now, there's debate about could that have been, did they line up exactly right? If you want to spend a few days reading about it, I've wasted a few hours, it's there. Whatever the point, there was a lot happening in the skies around 7 BC. Have a look at, they come to Israel looking for the king. It makes perfect sense to go to the palace, and so they do that in chapter 2, verse 3. When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. They absolutely were. King Herod Herod the Great, as he was known, was a Roman puppet king. His father Antipater had been involved in helping Rome take over Israel and Judea in about 63 BC. Somehow managed to get his son onto the throne. They were actually Idumeans, or descended from Edom. So Herod wasn't or converted to Judaism, and I suspect always felt kind of uneasy about his Jewishness as he ruled that nation. He was basically a monster. You may note, though, Herod died in 4 BC. Jesus is born while Herod's still alive. So how did that all work out? Paul Barnett says as follows. Since Herod died in 4 BC, Jesus must have been born in 7 or 6 BC to satisfy the detail of the search for the boys 2 years old. We'll come to that. Why is our Anno Domini calendar incorrect? It's because the 6th century monk Dionysius, when reforming a Roman calendar along Christian lines to pivot around the birth of Jesus, miscalculated the date of the death of Herod relative to the founding of Rome, the previous starting point for Western calendars. Missed it by 5 or 6 years. What we do know about Herod from other histories is, as I read, one scholar said pretty much his life was he'd feel paranoid about someone threatening his power or position, he'd have them murdered, he'd feel bad, he'd go on a building spree, kind of feel better, feel paranoid, and then there was that pattern. He killed his son-in-law for being too popular, his brother-in-law for being too popular, a couple of his sons plotting against him, and one of his wives. There was an old saying that it was safer to be Herod's pig than Herod's son. Perhaps the story that indicates the kind of man he was best is this. J. Josephus, the Jewish historian, says, when Herod knew that he was going to die, he gave orders for the leading citizens of Judea to be arrested and held captive, and then said, the moment I expire, have them, the leading citizens, massacred, and so shall all Judea and every household weep for me, whether they will or not. So you won't weep for me, but you will weep when I die. Josephus says that order was not carried out, but that's the kind of man that Herod was. Now, verse 4, that's why Jerusalem is troubled when there's a new king being born. When he called together, verse 4, when he called together all the people's chief priests and the teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah, the Jewish way of speaking of the great king, the Hebrew way, Christ, the Greek word for that, where the Messiah was to be born. In Bethlehem in Judea, they replied, for this is what the prophet has written. And then they quote the prophet Micah from the Old Testament. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. The town of Bethlehem is not random. The great king David was born in Bethlehem. It's very close to Jerusalem. I don't know if you can see, maybe 9-10 kilometres in those days. As the cities have grown, they got even closer together. So Bethlehem, just 2 hours' walk from Jerusalem. Verse 7. Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He's not asking them to come up at 7 p.m. or 8 p.m. He's asking them, how many months ago did this star appear? He sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him. Now I thought, did Herod actually believe the prophecy? I would suspect, no, that he doesn't believe the prophecy, but he's concerned that other people might. And so as this child grows, he will be a threat to Herod's power. Verse 9. After the Magi had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star that they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. So the star took them in the direction of Bethlehem. Bethlehem, just a little village. It'd be easy to find the little family. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. Verse 11, on coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Gold is obvious. Frankincense is a milky white resin extracted from a species of a particular tree that thrives in the Arabian Peninsula and East Africa and India. Myrrh is a reddish resin that comes from a species of unpronounceable tree, which is native of northeast Africa. Frankincense and myrrh were desired for personal, religious and medicinal use. In a time before daily bathing, people would use the sweet smoke from the resins to make themselves smell better. Other ailments were once reported to cure included hemlock poisoning, leprosy, worms, snake bite, diarrhea, plague, scurvy, and even baldness. There you go. Where is it when you need it? So the gifts are given, and you say, why we think three wise men, but it doesn't say that, three gifts. Now, verse 12, having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. When they'd gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. Get up, he said. Take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt and stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him. To save the child's life, the angel sends him to Egypt. Josephus, the Roman historian, says Egypt would be a very good place to hide because there was something like 1 million Jewish people living in Egypt around the first century. And so the little family could travel there and just disappear into the crowd. Verse 14. So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, out of Egypt I called my son. Now, it's the idea of God calling his son out of Egypt. Let me just take a moment. If I lose you in this, don't worry too much. If you're used to reading the Bible, this might help you see a few things, but if you're not used to it, don't worry too much. In a minute, I'll come back. What Matthew is showing us is that Jesus in his life is reenacting the formation of the people of God. So Matthew deliberately shows how what Jesus does reforms or remakes the people of God. I'll show you what I mean. Israel begins with Moses and then the Exodus. And so Jesus is born under a tyrant, Herod, who tries to kill the boys because of paranoia. Moses is born under a tyrant, Pharaoh, who tries to kill the Hebrew boys because of paranoia. God brings Israel out of Egypt under Moses. God brings Jesus out of Egypt. Israel then spends 40 years in the desert learning the lesson, or trying to learn the lessons they need about faith and trust. Jesus, when he grows, spends 40 days in the desert and quotes from the same part of the Bible about time in the wilderness. Israel crosses the Jordan River to enter the Promised Land. Jesus is baptized in the Jordan River. Moses goes up onto the mountain and gets the Ten Commandments. Jesus goes up onto the mountain and gives the Sermon on the Mount. There are 12 tribes of Israel. How many disciples does Jesus choose? 12. He's come to reform the people of God. Just to think about that. Okay, now we're back. If I lost you, okay, we're back nice and to verse 16. When Herod realized that he'd been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious and gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he'd learned from the Magi. The Christmas cards that show Mary, Joseph and the baby, and then the shepherds, and then behind them the wise men are queued up saying, "Could you hurry up, please?" are totally wrong. The wise men, or the Magi, and the shepherds arrive perhaps 2 years apart, and Jesus is a toddler when the Magi arrive. And so it's hardly Disney, is it? The babies are murdered. The scholars tell me it may have only been, forgive the word only, it may have only been 20 or so children killed. Bethlehem's a small village, and yet it's tyrants and murder, and it's, our world hasn't changed that much. Verse 17, then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more. Old Testament background, about 1,800 years earlier, Jacob, who was known as Israel, a patriarch of the nation, his lovely wife Rachel dies in childbirth right near Bethlehem, and he builds a tomb for her there. And she becomes known in some ways as the mother of Israel. The quote there is from the book of Jeremiah, a prophet about 600 BC, and Jeremiah talks about Rachel weeping for her children when the Babylonians invade. Matthew says it's happened again. Rachel would weep for her children. Her tomb is right near Bethlehem. In fact, today, if you want to go, you can visit Rachel's tomb in Israel. There are websites to tell you how to do that and what to expect. And so verse 19, after Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who are trying to take the child's life are dead." So he got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in the place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee. Now, after Herod died, they divided his kingdom up. They were called tetrarchs, which is a ruler of a fourth or a quarter of a kingdom. One of his daughters got a city somewhere. She wasn't properly looked after. The three of his sons was divided. Herod Philip ruled in the north. The green was Herod Antipas. He's mentioned later in the Gospels. He's the Herod that had John the Baptist's head chopped off. And this red part here is what Archelaus ruled. And you notice he covered Jerusalem, etc. Archelaus was a chip off the old block. Brutal, cruel, insensitive. The portrait of the top 16th century, so we don't know what he looked like. There's some coins that Archelaus minted, etc. There was problems. He overreacted to some protests in Jerusalem, sent the army into the city and kind of coincidentally killed 3,000 civilians. He also took another man's wife. His brother Alexander died, and Alexander's widow married another man, and then Archelaus took her while she was still married to the man. Now, the people of Jerusalem protested so much about all of this that the Romans kicked him out in 6 AD. And just as an aside, if you've read the Gospels, because he'd committed adultery and taken this other wife, he lost his throne, or that was certainly part of it. I wonder if that is why his brother Herod Antipas reacts so strongly to John the Baptist saying, you shouldn't take another man's wife. That's 25 years later. A little aside. Anyway, they kicked Archelaus out in 6 AD. And what does that mean? Well, first of all, it means Jesus came back from Egypt before he was about 10 years old. He was no older than 10 years, or maybe 12 years old when he came back. The Romans set up an administrator rather than another king, an administrator in Judea from then on. Now, I don't know who the administrator from 6 AD to 26 AD was, but there was an administrator there from 26 AD to 36 AD. And I guarantee everyone in the room has heard his name. Anyone know the name? Pontius Pilate, yes. Now, we don't know what Pontius Pilate looked like. Here's a couple of actors who played him in recent biblical epics. I think the guy on the right is probably better looking. Verse 23, Joseph decides, because of Archelaus' cruelty and brutality, that he'll go back and live in the town of Nazareth. Verse 23, and he went and lived in a town called Nazareth, and so was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, he would be called a Nazarene. The slightly tricky thing is this: there's no quote in the there's no prophecy in the Old Testament that says he'll be called a Nazarene. As you read the commentators, I think the best answer is this: Nazareth was Nowheresville. To be from Nazareth was to be mocked. And I grew up in Grafton, and before you think Grafton's Nowheresville, Grafton's a thriving little metropolis, but there's always a town that everyone looks down on. So for us, it was a little place called Jacobia down the river, where we'd say people had six fingers and all that kind of thing, and you'd laugh if you came from Jacobia, saying that's what it was like for Jesus to come from Nazareth, to be mocked, to be despised. And so Matthew's set this up beautifully. At the end of chapter 1, if you were here last week or if you've read it, he finished by saying the virgin will conceive, give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. At the end of chapter 2, he's saying he'll be called a Nazarene. Meaning what? That some will realise that here is God become one of us and worship him, and there are others who will say he's from Nowheresville and they will despise him. And that's what's happened, really, isn't it? So to finish, Matthew chapter 2 is anything but Disney. We've got a young couple, she's pregnant outside of marriage and all the difficulties that that brings. We've got a tyrant who's paranoid and killing people, a young family who are refugees looking for asylum, and our world hasn't changed that much. And it's interesting to see the different reaction to people. That is, some hear of the birth of God's great king and they travel months to come and worship him. There are others who hear that that might be possible and they do their best to stamp him out, to oppose him, to even kill him. The strangest reaction of all, I think, is this: for the chief priests, the religious leaders who give the advice to Herod, there's no record that any of them did anything. They just didn't react. They were apathetic, or perhaps more likely too busy. After all, it was Christmas time. How did so many Jews come to be living in Egypt at the time? It's a very good question. There had been at least two massive invasions of the nation of Israel, the Assyrians in 724, and then the Babylonians between about 605 and 590 BC, and deportations of huge numbers of people. And so the diaspora started before the year 70. Particularly with the Babylonians, they were spread out across the empire. Now, some of them came back and rebuilt Jerusalem 70 or so years later, but many of them lived in the exile, in a diaspora. And so Josephus may exaggerate the numbers, but there were large numbers in Israel. If I could quote my favourite author, Rodney Stark, he estimates that 10% of the Roman Empire was Jewish, spread out all over the empire. So it's interesting that as the Apostle Paul travels with his team, in every town they go to, there are Jewish people, and in most of them, enough to have a synagogue. So Jewish people are spread out all over the Roman Empire. If Joseph and Mary are originally from Nazareth, why were they still in Bethlehem 2 years after Jesus' birth? Good question. My guess is that my best guess would be that they had family there because Joseph has returned to his ancestral town. He's a carpenter and so could find work easily. And it's 100 or so kilometres, maybe 140 kilometres from Bethlehem back to Nazareth. And my guess is there was a little bit of inertia with a toddler and etc. So they were still there. Well, the short answer is we're not told. How is the killing of the boys a fulfillment of the prophecy of Jeremiah, Rachel weeping for her children? Is the context of the Babylonian invasion relevant? Two questions about that. Yes, it's complicated. Matthew uses the Old Testament in what we might see as a looser way, and that is that prophecies in the Old Testament that point to a specific event at the time, he also saying that they point beyond themselves. So if you like, there's kind of multiple horizons. So the quote about the virgin giving birth to a child operates at the time of Isaiah in about the 8th century, but Matthew's also saying it actually pointed beyond itself to the 1st century. It's like that with the Rachel thing. I think what he means is Rachel's tomb is there. She wept as the Babylonians took people into captivity. She would also weep as these children have been murdered. I'm not sure that you can read more into it than that. Could the Magi visit bearing gifts also be compared to the Queen of Sheba's visit to the nation of Israel? Possibly. I can't think where it is, but I know one of the Psalms talked about that kings would come to him, to God's king, to the Messiah, bearing gifts, which is possibly where the idea of them being kings has come from. The Queen of Sheba comes from what would today be Yemen. It's around 2,000 kilometres on a camel that she's motivated, and she's come to see the wisdom and greatness of Solomon. Similar in a way, come to see the great king. Is there something scandalous or dodgy about the Magi outside Israel coming to this one as king? Yes, I think Matthew wants to show us not just that Jesus is king, but that from the beginning those outside of Israel have wanted to know the God of Israel and have been brought in. So last week we saw that Matthew deliberately includes some of the women who were Gentiles in the genealogy, and so the Magi turn up and they are the ones who look good in this story. And then you'll get to the end of the Gospel and Jesus will say, go into all nations and make disciples. So what is interesting is that across the sweep of the Bible says stay away from anything to do with magic, sorcery, mediums, astrology, that kind of thing. But it's very gentle on the way, Matthew's very gentle on the way that he treats these men. If the Bible is infallible and the reference to the prophets in verse 23 is the Old Testament prophets, is part of the Old Testament missing? Let me look at verse 23. I see. And he went and lived in a town called Nazareth, and so was fulfilled what was said through the prophets. He would be called a Nazarene. Depends how you look at that. Do you see the point? No one, not even Don Carson, the great scholar, can find the reference to say he'll be called a Nazarene. I don't think it's saying necessarily the prophets said he will wear a name tag that says Nazarene. It's saying he'll be, I think you read it generally as, he will be referred to in that way. When you get to John's Gospel, the fact that Jesus is from Galilee and is consequently despised by the leadership and the elites, and he's spoken very poorly of. And so you go back into the Old Testament, and there, for example, perhaps the most famous part of the Bible would be Isaiah chapter 53, where it says he's despised and rejected and etc. And then many of the Psalms speak like that as well. So I think it's the idea of a general thing that where he is from is part of the fact that he was not accepted, despised, looked down on.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.